Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, go to the events page, because on the events page, you will see the two upcoming events, the Here We Still Stand 2021 conference, which is taking place in October out in San Diego, and the Here We Still Stand regional conference, which is going to be in Bentonville, Arkansas in April. Now, you want to come to these both? I mean, I know you haven't been able to do much of anything over the last year. Why not come out to beautiful Northwest Arkansas in April? Spring in the Ozarks. You can do it. It's a great place to be in the spring. All the details are there. It's gonna be a good time. Chad's gonna be there. I'm gonna be there. Loso, Jared C. Wilson, Scott Keith, Andy Gullihorn's gonna be there performing an entirely live concert. Gretchen Ronovic, Eric Sorensen. It's gonna be a good time. 2-day event out in Bentonville. Come and hang out. Yes, we have an airport here. It's actually 15 minutes from the venue, so you can fly right in. It's gonna be great. Chad, we left Saul in an interesting spot last time. We just sort of ran out of time. We weren't really planning on leaving him there. It's not like us to leave someone just straight up in their sin, but this is what we did with Saul. Saul has confessed that he is a sinner. Samuel, presenting himself as not the greatest of pastors in this moment, refuses to absolve him, and Saul, and that's where he left him, just unabsolved and desperate, which, of course, is not what we mean to do. But
it's not a good place to be.
No, just left you guys all hanging there. So we find ourselves in that situation, and we have to pick it up from there.
Yeah, imagine going to your pastor and confessing, and then he doesn't give the absolution. Then you got to go back, and you got to confess again. Well, that's what Saul is going to do here. So we're picking up with verse 30 of 1 Samuel 15. So this is the second confession. Then Saul said, I have sinned, but please honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel, and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. Now this time, Samuel does. He didn't tell him he was forgiven, but he at least went back with Saul, and Saul worshiped before the Lord. And now, oh my goodness, prepare yourself for what's about to happen next, because things are going to get kind of violent with our friend Samuel. So Samuel, at this point, says, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. So if you remember from the previous episode, what precipitated this whole series of events was that God, through Samuel, told Saul to go and wipe out the Amalekites. But Saul and the people and his soldiers, they spared some of the best of the animals for sacrifice, and they also spared Agag, king of the Amalekites. And that's what led to this whole back and forth between Samuel and Saul, and the promise that God is going to tear away the kingdom from Saul and give it to someone else. So here we have King Agag, who probably at this point thinks that he can finally kind of breathe a sigh of relief. You know, everything's going to be okay. It's a little bit uncertain because let me read you the next verse, or the next part of the verse, and explain. So most translations have something like this. And Agag came to him cheerfully, and Agag said, that is, said to himself, surely the bitterness of death is past. The problem here is we don't know for sure how to translate the end of how Agag came to him. So did he come to him cheerfully, or did he come to him in bonds? Because actually it could be translated both ways. And as you can imagine, those are very different.
Yes.
And does he come to him like with handcuffs on, or does he come to him with a smile on his face? But it does seem, based upon what he says to himself, that the bitterness of death is past, that he's in a pretty good mood, you know? So maybe he does walk up, you know, with a little, kind of a light step, because he thinks that he is actually going to survive this whole ordeal. Well, he's wrong. Samuel, as soon as the king gets there, Samuel says, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed, hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal.
Yeah, this makes you think that he is probably bound. Samuel's like an old guy.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he's not like some 25-year-old warrior. He's an old prophet. I think it also kind of speaks to the whole mood. Probably too weak of a word, but the state that Samuel is in, he is not a happy man.
Yeah,
he's unhappy with God. We talked about that last episode. He's clearly unhappy with Saul. He's unhappy with the whole situation. It does seem as if he has been unhappy for quite a while, ever since the people rejected him and his sons and instead wanted a king instead. Samuel does not seem to be in the best of moods. And it's almost as if this particular breaking point was when it kind of all came out, and the object of his fury ended up being the Amalekite king, Agag, whom he hacked to pieces before the Lord.
The only thing we have from God in this story is that God tells Samuel that he's rejected Saul as king. Samuel is not happy. We know that he's angry. We argued that he's angry in general and also kind of angry with God as well. But you see this frustration play out in the way that he engaged with Saul. And now he just sort of is like, I'm not here to forgive anybody. Give me that sword. I'm going to hack this guy to pieces. Like, this is a dude that is upset.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I say, it does seem as if everything that was still pent up is finally released in this moment. And even in the manner of death. I mean, this is not, if you know from the rest of the rest of the stories about the death penalty, this is not the typical way that people are put to death. Now, maybe in battle. Yeah. I mean, if you're engaged in battle and you have a sword and the other guy has a sword or spear and you end up killing him with a sword, sure. But this is not the typical way that captives are put to death. So even the violent and gruesome way in which this execution is carried out tells us a little bit about the state of Samuel's mind.
Yeah, and it seems that he does not realize that Samuel is a very ticked off dude and comes up with the exact wrong disposition. So he kind of strolls up like little cocky, little happy, and this is the exact wrong attitude to take with this particular angry prophet.
Yeah, that was probably not a worse way to approach Samuel at this particular point than with an air as if he had everything made and was going to get off the hook for this.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's two more verses in this chapter, but to be honest, this is really where the chapter ends as far as this particular account. Verses 34 and 35 really belong to chapter 16, because that is going to shift the story to a different focus. And as we will soon see, this is really where, in some ways, the book truly begins, in the sense that this is when the story of David begins. I mentioned more than once that 1 and 2 Samuel really could have been called 1 and 2 David, because ultimately these books are not about Samuel. They're all leading up to and then documenting the life of David, not of Samuel and not of Saul. So Samuel is there to prepare the way for David, and Saul is in many ways there to prepare the way for David. But the books are really all about the preparation, kind of laying the groundwork for his emergence, and then telling the story of his gradual ascendancy to the throne of Israel, and then what happens when he becomes king. So we're going to meet the man of the hour in these verses that are coming up here. He's been hinted at a couple times. Saul has been told that God is going to look elsewhere. He's going to look for another man. So we've had David hinted about more than once, but we have not yet been introduced to him. Well, the moment has arrived. So let me finish off 34 and 35, and then we will launch into the introduction of David. So after Samuel kills the king of the Amalekites, Samuel went to Ramah, which was his hometown, and Saul went up to his house at Gibeah of Saul. So they part ways, and they both go to their hometowns. And then we have this verse, which is looking forward to what is to come. Samuel, it says, did not see Saul again until the day of his death. For Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel.
Yeah,
that verse in itself tells us that something big is coming up if the prophet never sees him to the day of his death.
Yeah, and I think this is the sort of verse that really lets you know when Samuel is angry and crying out with God, and you know that he is upset and not angry at Saul in a way that he is that he hates Saul or something like this. I mean, we see that Samuel never wanted Saul to be king. Obviously, he didn't want anyone to be king. But it does seem that Samuel, in some ways, loves Saul, and feels badly for him. And we see this play out as he like grieves over Saul. And then we have this thing, you know, as Samuel says, "Hey, you know, God's not a God that has regrets." And we end this chapter with this statement again, even though we are told he is not like us, that he would have regrets. Yet here he says the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. And I think that even that is, I don't read any anger into that either. I think that that is also that God is saddened by the entire thing. I mean, he's saddened that in the rejection of him and them demanding the king in the first place, and then Saul is ill-suited to be king, and this hasn't worked out well for Saul, hasn't worked out well for the people of Israel, God doesn't like it. I think it's easy to sort of, you know, read the story, and especially as Saul begins to lose it more and more, and think that God really doesn't like Saul very much. And I would say that this is not true. I think that God loves Saul, and that at the end of the day, you see that men, no matter who they are, this will include David, they're all imperfect and they're all ill-suited to reign over the children of God.
Yeah, that's a great point to make. You know, when you think about the pressures that are placed on Saul, you think about the pressures that are placed on David, you think about the responsibilities that a person in that particular vocation have, no one is ready for it. I mean, we still have that, of course, in the church today, as well as in our nation. I mean, anyone who is under the kind of responsibility and stress that a leader with these kind of responsibilities has, well, humanity is sinful humanity, weak humanity, flawed humanity. You're just not able to bear up under that. You can almost be certain that there's going to be some breakage in that person. And that's going to be exemplified in a variety of ways, sometimes in major, sometimes in minor ways. But humanity is not made to bear up under that kind of burden. So what should surprise us? What should surprise us are those rare occasions when something catastrophic does not occur to a leader. What should not surprise us is when something catastrophic does occur to our leaders. When you think about the kind of weight that is placed upon their shoulders. So my heart goes out in many ways to Saul. Yes, he made his mistakes. He never wanted this job. He wasn't really equipped for this job. God didn't want the job to be held by any human being to begin with. So he was almost set up to fail from the beginning. I mean, this doesn't excuse his mistakes. It's no excuse for his sins, of course. But the situation that he was thrown into was one in which it was just about impossible for him to succeed anyway. And as we'll see in the life of David, I mean, it wasn't much different with him either, because even though he was a better person in many ways, a better leader in many ways than Saul was, it all got to him too. And I'm not talking about just the whole deal with Uriah and Bathsheba, but other things as well. We'll see his weaknesses exemplified in some other ways. So
yeah, I think it's just too easy to read a line like God regretted making Saul king and say, well, he regrets it because Saul sucks. I think it's deeper than that. I think it's, I regret putting this person in this position.
Yeah. Well, the whole situation, you know, they it was never good. They wanted a king. Wasn't good that he was in that situation. Just, The whole debacle was regrettable.
Yeah.
Okay, so really continuing the story, but beginning chapter 16, here's what we have in this first verse. Now the Lord said to Samuel, so Samuel's back home, God speaking to him now in a different situation. How long, this is telling, isn't it? How long will you grieve over Saul? So we don't know how much time has gone on, but Samuel's back home in Ramah. He's been just, I guess, grieving this whole time. He's in a state of mourning because of this situation. So God says, how long will you grieve over Saul since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons. And there's a couple of parallel statements we have to kind of bear in mind when we read this opening verse. Notice God says, I have rejected him for being king over Israel. The parallel to that is way back here in chapter 8, where the Lord says to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me. So the way this whole kingship thing got started was by the people rejecting God as their king. And now God turns around and says, I have rejected Saul for being king over Israel. So the rejection is working, first worked from the human to the divine. Now it's working from the divine down toward the human. And then secondly, he says, fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite. Now my translation, and I think the ESV as well. Okay, the ESV has, I have provided for myself a king from among his sons. Mine has, the New American Standard has, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons. In the Hebrew, it has, for I have seen to it, or for I have seen for myself a king who will reign over the Israelites, or a king for myself among his sons. So this introduces this idea of seeing that we're going to see throughout the 16th chapter, where God doesn't look at the outward appearance, he sees the heart, and we have Samuel seeing the sons, looking for the one that he thinks God has chosen, but God is not seeing as man sees. So the introduction of vision and the difference between what people see and what God sees is going to become a theme that's developed throughout this chapter. So God will see to it that he gets a king for himself among his sons. So he's got a mission. He takes his horn of oil and he goes down toward Bethlehem. But he's worried. Samuel says, how can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Now, just pause to think about that for a minute. God is engaged in, this is an act of divine deception, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no other really way to get around this. God says to Samuel, well, just lie, more or less. Maybe it's a half truth, half lie, but still, you know, you're going to have to cover this up. Evidently, now whether it's perceived or whether it's real, Samuel truly is worried that if Saul finds out, that he's going to kill him. You know, so I don't know. I mean, is it true that Saul is already kind of this murderous and afraid he's going to lose his throne? Or is this Samuel just kind of being overly concerned and unrealistically worried about what might happen? I really don't know. I mean, there's nothing so far that I remember in Saul's character which would indicate that he is just like has spies out watching Samuel and he's going to take him down. He's going to take him out if there's any hint whatsoever of him trying to anoint somebody else.
Well, it seems like maybe what Samuel is concerned about is that Saul is going to respond poorly, somewhat understandably, to this whole arrangement. Because yes, Saul has confessed his sin and stuff, and this leads you to believe, like, I don't know, why would he be so upset? It doesn't seem like we didn't leave him in some seemingly enraged, you know, place.
Yeah.
But, you know, Samuel might be like, look, I know he messed up, but I think that he's not going to love this, and this is going to seem a little unfair to him.
It's always dangerous to anoint someone as king when there's already another king.
Yeah, and especially when it's like, yeah, well, I told you he rejected you, and maybe other people aren't as sympathetic to Saul as I apparently am, but... I would understand why he'd be like, yeah, I guess I'll just go back to my house then. I mean, like, if I was Saul, I'd be like, I didn't ask for this. Now you've given this to me. I didn't mess up horribly. Like everything, it wasn't like the kingdom's been taken over or something crazy. Like it's right. Like, yeah, I've done a decent job, and he's like, yeah, you're out. We're gonna anoint.
He didn't introduce any idolatry like most of the kings of Israel did.
Yeah, like yeah. so. you know, Samuel's probably like, I don't know. He might not take that great. And yeah. I think the reason Samuel thinks that, and maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, but I think the reason he thinks that's a distinct possibility is because most people wouldn't take that great. Because yeah. the thing to point to for the rejection, it almost seems like the punishment doesn't fit the crime, right?
Right, 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 yeah. Whatever's going through his mind, he's certainly worried, and God acknowledges that and says, okay, all right, well, here's what you do. Just take a cow with you. Everything will be fine. Take a heifer and tell him that you're going to sacrifice, which, I don't know, it seems like it's a pretty flimsy cover story because Samuel is way up north. Why in the world would he take a heifer with him all the way down to Bethlehem? So Saul's area is mainly the northern part of the tribes. And Bethlehem is way down south. I mean, it's south of Jerusalem. So it's in the the southern part of where the tribes are at. So that's a long way for Samuel to go just to make a sacrifice. But I mean, as far as cover stories, it's going to have to work.
Well, you can imagine this. Samuel's coming down. He's got that heifer. Saul's like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm coming down here to make a sacrifice. And Saul knows if there's one thing he should not be talking to Samuel about is how you should and should not sacrifice things.
Yeah, well, this is true. is part of their history, isn't
it? So maybe it's the perfect cover story. He's like, hey, I'm going to do this sacrifice. And Saul might be thinking, like, why would you do that? But he's like, I'm probably not going to bring it up.
Yeah,
I'm not going to bring up like how you should or shouldn't sacrifice what you should or where you should. I'm not really wanting to wade into the sacrificial conversation with this guy.
So maybe it was actually the perfect cover story. Well, he gets there. Oh, and then he said, well, there's more to it. Verse 3, it says, once you get there, you shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice. And I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me the one whom I say to you, the one whom I designate to you. So it's kind of interesting that, I mean, he tells them, of course, where to go. He tells them which father to look for. But he doesn't tell him which son it's going to be. That's a little open-ended. And so, you know, as a reader of the story, we're like, oh, this is interesting. You know, I wonder which... We don't even know at this point, like, how many sons there are to choose from. Are there two? Are there three? Are there 10? So it's kind of open-ended at this point. But you can also see God kind of, almost as it were, maybe testing Samuel. See, like, we're gonna see which son Samuel thinks is going to be the king. So anyway, we'll see what happens as the story goes on. So Samuel did what the Lord said. He went down to Bethlehem. And by the way, Bethlehem, you know, kind of has a spotty reputation. I mean, when we think Bethlehem, we think, oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie, you know, this sweet village. Well, if you remember that from this sweet village, we have two of the most horrific, dark stories in the history of the Bible, all from Judges, because the concubine that eventually got cut into 12 pieces and gang raped, she was she was a daughter of Bethlehem. And then the Levite in the story preceding that one, who ended up kind of, you know, making himself a priest for hire in this temple of idols. Well, he was from Bethlehem, or he passed through Bethlehem anyway. Now, Naomi and Ruth were from Bethlehem. So that's a good story connected with this particular city. But it's not as if at this point in the biblical narrative, we think Bethlehem and we think, oh yeah, great place, you know, just awesome little village where everybody's pious and holy.
Yeah, and in reality, Bethlehem's kind of a big nothing too.
Yeah, it's just a backwater village.
Yeah,
right.
It's nothing special about Bethlehem.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, it really is. I mean, it continues that pretty. I mean, the only thing that's big about Bethlehem is the fact that it's David's hometown. Mm-hmm. I mean, even to the point of the New Testament, Bethlehem was still just kind of a bedroom community to Jerusalem. I think it's 7 miles, something like that, south of Jerusalem. But anyway, that's where they go. And I love the response of the elders of the city. They're not happy to see Samuel. It says the elders of the city came trembling to meet him and said, do you come in peace? Yeah, they're probably thinking, this is not good. anytime like a powerful man like Samuel comes all the way down here to us in this kind of no account village, it can't be good.
Might be the last thing that they heard about Samuel, like, hey, that's that prophet freaking hacked this king to pieces and then went and disappeared for a little bit. And then you see him come wandering down the road. You might be like, oh, who did it? Who did what?
Right. Yeah. This is not going to end well. Whatever he's here for, it's not going to end well. So they're, do you come in peace? I mean, like shaking all over, they're trembling. And he reassures them. He says, shalom. You know, it's all good. I come in peace. He says, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. So he tells them to consecrate themselves and then to come with him to the sacrifice. And then Jesse shows up. I'm thinking probably Jesse is one of these guys. Like he's one of the elders of the city. We're not told that, but I'm just assuming that because it says that he also consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. I wish I knew what it meant when he says that he consecrated them. I honestly don't know.
I mean this whole this
what exactly
whole,
that looked like.
I mean, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, play one on the podcast, but the as far as I can tell, like this whole thing is a little bit weird. Like these sort of like sacrifice, like impromptu sacrifice is a weird thing. Like this is not normal. It's, I mean, there's not a lot of instances where a guy just show up like, yeah, I'm going to do a sacrifice. So, you know, get ready. Like we're going to sacrifice it. Usually like something needs to happen. You're seeking the Lord's wisdom on some matter or it's a day in which you typically sacrifice. This is like a pretty random sacrifice. And I would think that not just Saul, but the other people involved in this are like, what's going on?
Like, yeah, it is. It's very strange. I mean, we know from the Torah that sacrifices are supposed to take place at one spot,
yeah,
at the Lord's altar. Well, clearly the Lord's altar is not in Bethlehem. So even the fact that God's prophet is here to offer a sacrifice, a little strange.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
this whole ordeal is odd.
Maybe you have a non-typical sacrifice. If you just, you know, the Philistines came running down on you and then you beat them all, you might say, let's make a sacrifice. Like, but this makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is just like, yeah, just travel down here, think about doing a little sacrifice. And yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, it's very, very, very out of the ordinary. So he gets everybody ready. He's getting everybody consecrated, ready for the sacrifice. Verse 6 picks up the story of the sons. So verse 6 says that it came about when they entered. That is when Jesse, specifically when Jesse and his sons entered, that he looked at Eliab. So Eliab is going to be the oldest of these sons of Jesse. And Samuel says to himself, ah, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And so the Lord says to Samuel, think again. He says, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. That's the same verb, by the way, we had in verse 1 where God rejected Saul from being king.
I have rejected him. See, this is one of the reasons also where I'm like, you got to be careful with this word rejected. God has rejected Saul, therefore he hates him. Same word here. This is not a rejection in some kind of like election sense or something like this, or a salvific sense. Yeah. This rejection is, that's not the one.
Mm-hmm. That's precisely right. Yeah. He's not the one I've chosen.
Yeah.
I got my eye on somebody else. And then it goes on. This is the Lord speaking kind of self-referentially. He says, for God, meaning me, for God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So this is what I mentioned earlier back in verse 1, where God will see to it a king for himself. And that same verb is used here. So, of course, this makes sense. I mean, when we're looking at people, especially on first impressions, we're not looking at their heart. I mean, first of all, we can't really, and that doesn't mean literally. It just means that, you know, what's going on inside, what kind of person they are, because we don't know when we first meet somebody.
Yeah.
You know, when we first meet someone, we're looking at the outward appearance. That's just the way it works with humanity. Now, sure, as we get to know them, we get to know more about their strengths and weaknesses, their personalities, all that kind of stuff that makes up what the Bible describes as the heart, because the heart is the epicenter of the human being. When we tend to think of a person's, you know, their, we'll sometimes speak loosely, like the emotions are connected with the heart and the thoughts are connected with the mind. We'll make these kind of distinctions. But in the Hebrew mindset, the heart is everything. The heart thinks, the heart feels, the heart is where the essence of a person is. So the heart is the central organ that does all the stuff for people. So God looks at that rather than the outward appearance.
Yeah, it's also what you shouldn't take this to be, which I've heard many times. What God is looking at, he's looking at David, which is where he'll land, obviously. He's looking at his heart, and he can tell that David's like just a better person than all these other guys. And we know that this is probably not true. That what God is looking for, like we, and I know we mentioned this, you know, David would be called a man after God's own heart. All of this is God looking for a heart that is like his, but also like a heart that he is going to make like his, right? Mm-hmm. This is not, yeah. It's not strictly like, oh, good, finally, the super moral, upstanding, good, right down to his heart person I've been looking for. Because this is not David.
Yeah. In fact, we have great proof for that. We have proof from David himself for that.
Yeah.
So if you look in Psalm 51, where David prays, create in me a clean heart, O God.
Yeah.
The verb that's used there is bara, which is the word used in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God barad. He created the heavens and the earth. And that's the verb that always and only has God as the subject. So only God can do bara. Only he can create. And that's ultimately what he has to do for David. He creates in him a clean heart, the kind of heart that God desires.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind. Keep Psalm 51 in mind when you read about God looking at the heart here in verse 7. So we have Eliab, the oldest, rejected, not chosen. So Jesse calls the next in line. He calls Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Then Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. All right, so we got three sons so far. And the first one is clearly, explicitly rejected. The second two are just kind of dismissed. Nope, not him. Third, nope, not him. So far, actually, at this point, we still don't know how many sons Jesse has, but we're about to find out. So verse 10 says, thus Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. But Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. So we got one left, right? This is a great time to pause and remember that the number eight has significance in the scriptures. We have circumcision taking place on the eighth day. Eight is connected with the week of creation because it's like the day after the fullness or the completion of something. And we have multiple examples of this in the scriptures where seven things, 7 days, 7 events will pass. And then the eighth one becomes the chosen one, becomes the significant one. And that's what we're going to have here in the case of David as well. So he makes the seven sons pass. Samuel says to Jesse, is this it? Are these all the kids? And he says, I love this. This has always been one of my favorite passages because it's almost as if Jesse has kind of forgotten about his youngest son. Like he didn't think about bringing him in. He's like, oh yeah, there remains one more. I got the youngest, but look, he's out taking care of the sheep. So Samuel says to Jesse, send and bring him, because we will not sit down until he comes here. You just got to love this whole scene. You're like, I mean, how far out is he? I mean, is he like right outside of town? Is he 3-4 miles away from Bethlehem? We don't even know, but they're just all standing around. And I'm just kind of imagining this really quiet room.
Yeah, wow, no, just, this is a weird thing to say. No one's going to sit until you get him in here.
Yeah. We're not even going to relax. Nobody's going to sit down. We're not going to eat. We're just going to have this awkward silence until somebody brings me your youngest son. So, and he's out taking care of the sheep. That's important. David being a shepherd by vocation is not just kind of an unimportant detail. As it turns out, It's very common in the ancient Near East for kings to be referred to as shepherds, because they would, of course, shepherd the nation. And I can't remember which psalm, but in one of the psalms, it says that God took David from tending the sheep to shepherd the people of Israel. So the very fact that he's a shepherd has a hint of regality to it. There's a kind of almost a wink that this one is going to be the one who will shepherd the people of Israel based upon his vocation of shepherding sheep.
And of course, you know, you have David is the line that Christ will come from. David prefigures Christ in a bunch of ways. Mm-hmm. And of course, Christ will take up this good shepherd mantle, over the New Testament, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, we are about to come face to face with, arguably, and I think in my opinion, decisively, the most important prefigurement of Christ in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
I mean, you can point to a lot of examples: Adam,
Joseph.
Noah, Joseph, Joshua, mm-hmm. Moses. I mean, there's plenty of examples of how various figures give us kind of a pencil sketch that Christ fills out in full color, but none would compare to David.
Well, in fact, Jesus doesn't go around saying he's the son of Joshua.
We'll yes, put it that exactly. Way. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I think I had this line in the book I'm writing right now about Christ in the Old Testament. Something like, you know, if you were you're in the first century Jerusalem, you stop some random stranger on the street and ask him, hey, you know, who of all of your forefathers is the Messiah mostly going to be like? I don't think there'd be a moment's hesitation. I think they would have said, well, David, of course. Yeah. I mean, what other option would there be? Of course, he's the son of David. So we're gonna see just how many ways David is providing the blueprint for the Messiah. But we have to get him anointed first. So let's get that done. So they're standing awkwardly around waiting for him to get there. So he sent, brought him in. We have a physical description of David, which is kind of funny because we were just told that the physical appearance doesn't matter.
This is hilarious, by the way. They're like, God doesn't look on the outward appearance. Yeah. He only looks at the heart. They go get this kid, and they're like, and this dude was handsome, and man, those eyes.
Yeah, I know.
Like, what?
Just cracks me up. It's like we just can't resist. You know, we've got to tell you a little about what he looked like.
Yeah, God doesn't look at the heart. Go get Justin Bieber. Like,
yeah. We're told he was ruddy, Admoni in the Hebrew. That can mean either redheaded or ruddy, like red-complected. The same description we have of Esau, by the way, back in Genesis. So he was either a redhead or he was kind of, you know, reddish complected with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. But don't worry. All that matters is the heart. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. That's the man. So Samuel takes the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel got up and went to Ramah, which sounds kind of an anticlimactic way to end this particular section.
He was done. He's like, that's the end.
Yeah. Put a bow on that. I'm done.
It'd be funny if he took the heifer back with him. Like, you know what? Sacrifice is off. Yeah. I don't think it's in the text that they actually did this thing.
No, it's not. There's no record of a sacrifice. Yeah. So, yeah, that's we're up at our 40 minutes, but check out if you have your Bible close by, check out Psalm 45 verse 7. There's a great tie in there because it talks about the Messiah being anointed in the midst of his brothers, which of course is exactly what just happened here. But we'll see what happens next time, because we've met David. All right, he's a shepherd. He just got anointed in a secret sort of way. There's nothing that's like, this isn't a big PR moment here. This is all really, really undercover at this point. But as we'll find out in the next half of the chapter, all of a sudden David is going to be launched really into the limelight, because as we'll see in the verses that follow, he ends up being the court musician for the king himself.
Yeah. Well, this is the one way that David does not prefigure Christ, is that We hear that Christ has there's nothing about him, his appearance, that would be memorable. But apparently, David, this is not the case.
Yeah, apparently not. Yeah.
Apparently, he's got the heart and the looks.
No wonder all the girls were singing songs about him. Yeah.
Right. Well, guys, be back next week as we switch main characters in the book of 1 Samuel. Make sure you go over to the website and register for the upcoming events in April and October. We'd love to see you at one or both of those events. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.